support comes from Ohio State's Ross Heart Hospital, helping to build healthy hearts with the 2013 Wellness Series. Heart disease is the leading cause of death in the United States, and regular physical activity is a great way to prevent it. Details about Ohio State's Wellness Series are at go.osu.edu/series.
In the United States, one in five children and one in three adults is obese, clinically obese. And it's no wonder anymore. We don't move as much. And the things we eat, every year the average American eats three times the amount of cheese as we did in 1990. We eat twice as much salt as recommended. And in a year, 70 pounds of sugar. That's not even getting into what the diet costs us in health and wealth. The problem, let's face it, is addiction. Or is it? Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Michael Moss considers that question in his new book, Salt, Sugar, Fat. Michael Moss is a New York Times reporter. He's also worked at the Wall Street Journal, Newsday, and the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. He joins us now. Welcome to the show, Michael.
Thanks for having me.
At the top of the hour, I referred to our dependence on the foods and the food industry's dependence on our dependence. In terms of our dependence on the food, is that just a nice word for addiction?
You know, it sounds a little like codependent.
Yeah, it does.
There's no word that the industry hates more than the A word, addiction. They argue that, that food cravings lack some of the technical thresholds that are applied to narcotic addiction, and they prefer terms like alluring and craveable. But no matter, and I have to say, I was sympathetic with them until I met Nora Volkow, the head of the National Institute on Drug Abuse, she's a scientist, and she's done neurological studies on both narcotics and highly palatable food and how the brain reacts. And she's concluded that for some people, some of us, which means many people, the most, highly sugary, highly fat, alluring foods are every bit as addictive as some narcotics. And even worse for those people, she's so empathetic that if you're in that situation, she sees your situation as even being more difficult than a narcotic addiction, because you can't just go cold turkey on food. We need food to survive. And so she urges people in that situation to avoid the junkier food out there, because you can't just stop at two cookies. For the rest of us, I think, it's an issue of sort of stress in our lives, our growing dependence, as you mentioned, on processed foods and convenience foods, and the incredible effort being made by the industry to make their products as alluring as possible. All of that drives us to buy more, eat more, and their products fly off the shelves.
If you're just joining us, this is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News, and I'm talking with Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Michael Moss about his new book. It's called Salt, Sugar, Fat. If you have a question or comment for Michael Moss, you're welcome. 614-292-8513. You can email us at allsides@wosu.org or check out our Facebook page. Michael, a doctor I work out with, a family physician I work out with in the morning, was quick to say this morning when I told her I was going to talk to you that there's nothing to do about all of this because you can't ban food. And you noted in your book that food studies don't have the rigor of double-blind randomized trials that drug companies undergo. And nobody is studying food addictions per se like they did, say, nicotine.
Yeah, the industry makes the argument, and rather convincingly, that it never intended to make America obese or otherwise ill, that wouldn't be in their financial interest, and that any one of their products can't be blamed for the obesity crisis, including soda. While some people may disagree with that, you're right. What's the issue here is sort of the collective nature of the most highly processed foods, and again, coming back to your word, sort of our growing dependence on them. But I guess I would disagree with the physician. I actually think there's a lot that can be done, both on the part of consumers just going shopping, and there's lots of tricks you can use and walking into the grocery store. Certainly on the part of these food companies, they have, you know, they have really smart people on their staff who could be applied to inventing new foods that are not so reliant on huge amounts of salt, sugar, fat.
You tell us in the book right off the bat about the 1999 meeting by the head honchos of America's largest food companies at the time, Pillsbury, General Mills, Nestle, Coca-Cola, Mars, Kraft, Nabisco, and Procter & Gamble.
Yes.
You didn't find out about the secret meeting until several months into your research for this book. I thought that was pretty interesting.
Yeah, I mean, the reporting and research for this book was for me like a detective story. And one of the things I came across was a trove of internal confidential documents in the food industry that really opened doors to their strategy, plotting, scheming, planning, internal discussions where they're talking to one another. And this meeting was evident in those documents. And the documents in turn helped me to convince top officials in the industry to divulge even more secrets about what they've done. And if you'd like, we can talk about the 99 meeting.
I do want to talk about it because, in terms of the idea that you mentioned earlier, that they said they never intended this to happen. But the 99 meeting suggested to me that, well, maybe they never intended to get there. But once they were there, they certainly intended, at least some of them, to pursue it to the end.
Well, yes. And look, going into this process, I mean, we knew that these foods, if you overeat them, they can make you ill. And we knew generally about their reliance on salt, sugar, fat. But now we know through these documents and interviews that they've known for years and years what their products are doing collectively. And the stunning thing about the 1999 meeting is that one of their own, a senior executive at Kraft, a highly respected official, got up and laid at their feet at least partial responsibility for the emerging obesity crisis. And he pleaded with them to collectively do something to turn the corner and help fight obesity. So, it wasn't like a health advocate from an organization standing up there. It was one of their own, one of their own executives, and that was such a powerful moment.
You know, when you say we know that this stuff is not good for us, it reminds me so much of we know it's not good to smoke.
Yes, I mean, there's lots of analogies to tobacco. In fact, the same official, Michael Mudd, drew that analogy to the very last, made a comparison of food to the very last thing the CEOs wanted to hear, which was to tobacco and the fragility of the public trust, both in the tobacco companies and the food industry. And we can talk more about the role of the very largest tobacco manufacturer in the processed food industry, Philip Morris, because it's totally surprising and fascinating.
I'm going to hold up my book just for the folks who might be watching on television, because the front cover of it is sort of a patchwork quilt of letters. The title's made up of a patchwork quilt, and it gets to the issue of how they attract us visually.
Yes. The artist went into a grocery store, grabbed all his own favorite, foods he hates to love, and, clipped out the letters and rearranged them to spell salt, sugar, fat, because that's sort of one of the themes, is that you can go into the store and you'll see, any package label, but the reality of it is going to be these three ingredients. These are the three pillars on which the holy grail, if you wish, on which the food industry depends. And they know through their research that when they hit the perfect amounts of these ingredients, they'll send us over the moon. Their products will fly off the shelves. We'll buy more, eat more. And, they being companies, they will make more money.
Yeah, you call it the bliss. Is that what you're talking about, the bliss?
So I walk the readers through the recent creation of a new soda flavor for Dr. Pepper by a legend in the industry named Howard Moskowitz. He has been at this for decades. And to create this new flavor, he came up with 61 separate formulas, each slightly different than the other of a new potential flavor, subjected those to more than 3,000 consumer taste testings, then threw all the data into his computer, did his regression analysis, and came up with the most precise, perfect amount of sugar sweetness for the soda that would guarantee it as a hit. And the thing about sugar is that you can get too much. I mean, and your listeners and viewers can do this experiment with coffee if they like sweet coffee. Just keep adding sugar till you get to the point that you really like it, and then add more, and you'll get to the point where you go, yuck, this is awful. Well, the bliss point for sugar is a bell curve, and at the top of the curve is the optimum amount of sugar that will excite the brain the most. And, you know, products throughout, as sugar and sweetness has spread throughout the grocery store from the dessert and, you know, ice cream aisle to any number of products, all of them now have a bliss point. So the precise calculation of what will really, as I said, you know, send people over the moon.
There is an interesting language that's spoken or referred to in the book. I love how, well, I don't know if I love this, but it's interesting how they speak, how they refer to, or you did, they refer to the phrase stomach share.
Yes. Sometimes they call it share of stomach. So, you know, this is the concept is basically, look, people are eating so much. We want them to eat more of our product. And so we are formulating marketing, advertising, packaging in order to gain more stomach share or share of stomach. And you hear them banty that expression around when they're talking to Wall Street analysts who sort of totally get that. That's one of my favorite parts of the book is sort of the insider language that they use. Bliss point for sugar, mouth feel for fat, flavor burst for salt, on and on and on. And yes, stomach share is a great one.
My guest is Michael Moss. He's a Pulitzer Prize winning reporter. He works for the New York Times, and he's the author of a new book. It's called Salt, Sugar, Fat, How the Food Giants Hooked Us. If you have a question or comment for Michael Moss, you can give us a call at 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org or check out our Facebook page. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
This is 89.7 NPR News, your all-day NPR news station. And the WOSU Public Media Member Card Benefit of the Month for March is Chamber Music Columbus. Enjoy 2-for-1 admission for tickets purchased in March for the April 20th performance of the Keller Quartet. Support 89.7 NPR News at the $85 level and receive your member card. Just visit WOSU.org. Cloudy skies today, a high of 35, a slight chance of some light snow tonight, a low of 20 degrees, sunshine and a high near 40 on Friday. Support comes from Ohio Northern University, investing in the success of its students by offering more than $58 million in scholarships and financial aid annually. Nationally ranked academics and a 92% job placement rate are hallmarks of an ONU education. Explore Engineering Day is March 16th. ONU.edu. All Sides continues. This is 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides. If you've ever wondered how Americans got hooked on nicotine, recall the halcyon days and this 1960s era television ad.
What could be more refreshing than Newport menthol cigarettes? Newport refreshes while you smoke because only Newport has a fine white filter, menthol and mint, and a blend of great tasting tobaccos.
And then consider this circa 1980s commercial with two NBA superstars and one of the all-time best snacks in some people's opinion.
Kareem Abdul-Jabbar made a little bet with his good friend Larry Bird.
I'll tell you what, I bet you can't eat just one.
One Lay's potato chip. One
term. Kareem failed to mention that these were new Lay's potato chips.
A real bet. And if you lose, then I win the bet.
Crunchier Lay's potato chips with more potato taste. Uh-huh.
In both cases, they make us want it because it tastes good and almost sounds like it actually is good for us, which means how bad could it be to smoke it or eat it all the time? Still with us is New York Times reporter Michael Moss. He's author of Salt, Sugar, Fat. The book breaks down the machinations of the $1 trillion processed foods industry. You refer in the prologue. Well, let's talk about the advertising first. We talked a little bit about the book, but the advertising is incredible. When I just kind of experimented and went on YouTube and just watched processed food ads.
It's really fascinating. And way back in the late 70s, federal regulators at the FTC became concerned, as did health advocates, because kids were getting bombarded on Saturday cartoon hours, especially with advertising for sugary foods. And they did an investigative report at the FTC and concluded, as we all know, that younger kids especially cannot distinguish between ads and reality. So when these cartoon characters, starting with Tony the Tiger and Sugar Frosted Flakes, would start, pitching these products, kids take that as fact and reality. And the FTC way back then tried to force the industry to cut back on its marketing of the junky, or rather the highest, sugar fat foods to kids. And they failed miserably. The industry fought back with huge lobbying power. There was a change of administration, and the effort to control marketing collapsed. And dial forward today, the industry is making some overtures, and some companies have cut back on their advertising to kids. But advertising and marketing remains, one of the most cunning and sort of powerful aspects of the processed food industry.
Don in Cincinnati, you're on the air with Michael Moss. Welcome, Don.
Yes, I hope that you don't exclude other chemicals in your book about the most enticing chemicals and substances for food. I'm particularly thinking of the ingredients in soup.
Yeah, I apologize. I do, and it's not because all of the other chemicals, many of which we can't even pronounce on the labels, are...
I'm thinking specifically of monosodium glutamate.
Yeah.
In soup, they have about four or five different ways of mentioning monosodium glutamate
Oh, that's a really good point. That's a really good point. I do mention MSG in the context of sodium because not only if you're concerned about sodium levels, as many, many people are because of its links to high blood pressure, you can't just look at the salt that's added in the product because they're adding sodium compounds to do all kinds of functional purposes as well as taste. And certainly MSG is one of those sodium compounds, not to mention the very sort of controversial aspects of it, in that at least some people appear to be quite allergic.
Thank you, Don, for that call. You said that one of the most unsettling aspects of the roles of sugar, fat, and salt is what the food industry does to alter them.
Yeah, so salt, for instance, I used to think it was, a rock they pulled out of the ground and rounded up a little bit and kind of like would come out of your salt shaker. But they have manipulated, if you will, or reshaped salt in several dozen ways to accommodate the needs of the processed food industry and to maximize what they call the flavor burst. So salt comes in, extremely fine powders that will dissolve more easily in soups, all the way up to one of my favorites, which is a kosher type of salt that looks like snow, but it's actually little pyramids with flat sides hollowed out in the middle so that your saliva has maximum contact with the salt. And, of course, it's the saliva that hits the taste buds and then send the signals to the pleasure center of the brain, and this is true for sugar and fat as well, to, eat more. This is nice, Michael. Keep going. I was really struck by how they can even change the structure of salt and sugar and fat as well. Now, some of this may be to the good. For instance, there, you know, Nestle is looking at ways of altering the shape and solubility of fat globules that might actually help us reduce our ingestion of the bad fats saturated. But still, it's a really fascinating thing that it's not just salt, sugar, fat as we used to imagine.
Are we talking about any at all about nanotechnology here?
You know, nano is coming up, and I really want to take a look at that. So little is known at this point, and it's not in my book, but I totally want to have an examination of that because it's starting to worry some people, and I'm not sure the extent to which it's actually being used yet by the industry. It's the food industry is very secretive, and I don't mean that in a vile, evil way. I mean they protect their patents, their formulations, their strategies from one another and the public. And I have to say, I mean, almost every fact in this book was hard fought over. You just don't, they don't like to divulge very much. And again, that's why I was so fortunate to run across these thousands and thousands of pages of internal documents that really laid bare so much of their enterprise.
I was surprised by the amount of frankness from some of the companies you worked as you worked on your book, and some of the former executives.
Yeah, you know, I interviewed any number of top scientists and marketers, and you know, I have to say, I mean, these are really likable people, and many of them have come to have substantial regret about what they did. Some of them invented these products in a more innocent era when our dependence on them was much less, and then saw the obesity crisis emerge and saw foodstuffs that they intended to be used as a treat, you know, being eaten, you know, on a daily basis along with others like them. The former president of Coca-Cola North America, South America, is just one of my favorite stories in the book. He worked at Coke for 20 years, was one of their fiercest warriors. He knew all about targeting kids. He knew all about targeting what they call heavy users, the biggest consumers of Coca-Cola. He knew all about the Super Size Me phenomena. And starting in 2000, he had a complete change of heart. He came to regret how Coke was marketing, especially to emerging middle-class communities in Brazil. Came back, tried to work on water and downsizing its marketing of Coke to kids in school. And I caught up with him today, and he is now marketing selling fresh baby carrots for what he calls his karmic debt, which is just and he's marketing them in one of the most brilliant ways. I mean, he's stolen a page from the playbook of the junk food industry in marketing carrots as something fascinating and exciting and interesting to kids. And if you think about it, you walk into the grocery store, all of the advertising marketing effort is devoted to the highly processed foods, the ones loaded with salt, sugar, fat. And you go to the fresh fruits and vegetable aisles, and there's nothing. It's boring, and it's more expensive.
But...
Yes.
The carrots.
But the carrots. He's got this idea that if they could just shift, if we, the country, can just shift some of the millions and millions of dollars spent on promoting the highly processed food products to fresh fruits and vegetables, then kids and parents and everybody will be much more interested in eating more of them, which everybody says we should be doing.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. My guest is Michael Moss. He's a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, reporter for The New York Times, and author of Salt, Sugar, Fat. If you have a question or comment for Michael, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. I have an email from Angel, and I don't know whether you could actually answer her question, but it reminded me of the first line in the chapter on sugar. She says, do psychological medicines intensify these cravings for sugar, salt, and fat? I make most of the food I eat, but I still crave the sugar.
I have heard, and I haven't looked at the science, that some of those medicines can be linked to weight gain. And if that's true, then yes, you know, sugar, your sweet tooth may be increased. I do know that the very astute researchers at an organization called the Monell Center in Philadelphia have looked at sweet taste in kids and know that, for example, a child can immerse their hand in cold, icy water and hold it there for a longer period of time if they're you know, sucking on a candy or something sweet in their mouth, or that a sweet will stop a kid from crying, for example. There's some really strong sort of brain stuff going on with our sweet tooth. We are all hardwired for sweets, I should mention too. Right. I mean, every one of our 10,000 taste buds, and this is especially true for kids, is attuned to picking up the sweet signal and sending it to the brain.
Why is it especially for kids? Just because they have fresh taste buds that aren't all beaten up?
No. I mean, the best thinking is that, you know, kids need calories. They're growing.
Okay.
And sugar is seen by the brain as just being instant rush of energy. And the brain's not sort of, you know, necessarily making the distinction between more long-lasting, you know, wholesome growth from grains, you know, complex carbohydrates. It's the sugar is just like a blast of energy.
Here comes, this is an email from Terry. I'm sure you've heard this before, as have the executives at that 99 meeting. The entity that forces us to overconsume must be the same that keeps us from exercising and prevents us from educating oneself. Whatever happened to personal responsibility and common sense?
You know, look, I mean, hats off to Michelle Obama for promoting the Let's Move campaign. I see she's just out in the field now for another anniversary run. And, you know, certainly the food industry likes to point to exercise as being, you know, a cure to obesity. It's certainly part of the equation, no doubt. But I think what Salt, Sugar, Fat, my book, is sort of hopefully doing is shedding light on just how difficult it is for people, even if you exercise. And you have to remember, too, that you have to put in a substantial amount of exercise to make up for calorie consumption. It's not the cure-all silver bullet that people might think. And so it's really sort of more about this, you know, of the playing field in the grocery store not being level. And you walk in the door and everything is done to get you to buy impulsively, for example, to steer you toward those higher fat, sugar, salt foods. And when you start eating them, I mean, even for many of us, it's really hard to stop at the little tiny servings that they have on the packages. And you played that commercial, you know, the bet you can't eat just one.
Right.
You know, that was a stroke of genius by Madison Avenue way back when, before the science, and they totally got it. They totally got how it's really hard for so many of us to stop at just one because these products are so irresistible.
David in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome, David.
Hi. Interesting topic. My question is, I've heard that if you eat a lot of salt, a lot of sugar, then you kind of lose your taste for other subtle taste as far as vegetables or fruits or things like that, so that you'll want to have a lot of sugar in your food. Is that true?
You know, the same scientists at Monell talked to me about, in their words, sort of the processed food industry exploiting the biology of the child. And one of the things they're most concerned about is how sweetness has spread through the grocery store so now that kids and adults expect sweetness in foods that didn't used to be sweet before. So bread, tomato sauce, pasta sauce, oh my gosh. Yogurt, of course. I mean, even low-fat yogurts can have as much sugar as ice cream. So I think, and there's even some concern about soda possibly, and the science is not good on this yet, soda possibly teaching us to look for sweetness in solid foods. And so I think that's one of the key issues here, too, is that, yes, they can certainly reshape your your palate, basically, and your expectation. And I should also say, too, to flip it around, I mean, one of the fascinating things to me is about the industry's own dependence on these three ingredients, salt being one of them. And salt is a miracle ingredient to the companies. It acts as a preservative and allows them the convenience, the long shelf life that's part of the processed food industry. So things can sit on the shelf for weeks and months at a time. It allows them to avoid using more costly ingredients like fresh herbs and spices. Salt is 10 cents a pound. It's almost as cheap as clean water in some parts of the world. And then it masks some of the off notes that are inherent to processed foods. And I can talk about my amazing sort of tasting experience.
I would like you to talk about that. That was interesting.
I really wanted to know from the industry why they were having so much trouble cutting back on salt, because everybody from the White House to the mayor of New York has been urging them to reduce their usage of salt so that we can fight high blood pressure in this country. And Kellogg invited me in, and I toured their very private research and development center. And then we sat down to eat some of their iconic products that they made for me, specially prepared without salt. And I have to say it was one of the most god-awful experiences I had. So it was me, and the head of their science team and a representative of the company. We started with Cheez-Its, the cracker, which normally I could eat all day long. And we could not even swallow the saltless Cheez-Its. They lacked texture and solubility. They stuck to the roof of our mouth.
The cheese wasn't enough?
No, the cheese wasn't enough. It really needed the salt in there. And then we moved to frozen waffles and popped them in the toaster, and out they came, and they looked and tasted like straw. And finally, the clincher was the cereal. We added some milk, took a bite. Before I could say anything, because my brain was going, oh, my God, the spokesperson for the company goes, oh, this tastes like metal, M-E-T-A-L. And the technician, the scientist goes, yeah, you know, not everybody tastes that, but you're right. One of the functions of salt is to mask and or kind of reverse these off tastes, including metal, which we get when we add a lot of vitamins and minerals and other, you know, other things to the products. So, I mean, for me, I have to say I had this image of one of the fillings of my mouth, teeth coming out, sloshing around my mouth. It was so metallic. It was absolutely stunning. So what the industry has found is that they've been able to cut back on salt by 10 or 15%, 20%, largely because they were adding so much before because it was so cheap. They never worried about the amounts. But going forward from that, they're finding it really, really difficult, both from sort of our taste perspective, but also from their technical needs. And I should mention one other thing. The startling thing to me about salt is that we're not born liking salt. We develop a taste for it at about 6 months old. And, you know, the best guess for the reason of that is that you really don't need very much sodium, which is the part of the salt that, A, you need, but also causes high blood pressure. So no inherent liking that there is for sugar and fat when you're born. They've also learned that your liking of salt is very much dependent on how much processed foods you get. There was a recent study that showed put kids into two groups, and those who were exposed to processed foods starting at age 6 months were, you know, more apt to be licking the salt shaker by the time they were in preschool. I don't know if your kids ever did that, but I actually caught my kids doing that once at a restaurant.
I saw it and went into denial.
Oh, my God. But the point I'm making is that, you know, not only are we not born liking salt, but it's easy for us to get off salt. You know, anybody who's been on a low-sodium diet under doctor's orders knows that after like 6 weeks or so, they can't even go into the grocery store without looking at it as a minefield of foods that taste way too salty. It's easy to sort of scale back your taste for salt much, much, much easier than it is for the industry to get unhooked.
My guest is Michael Moss, author of a new book. It's called Salt, Sugar, fat. If you have a question for him, 614-292-8513. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
I'm Lynn Neary. Every day brings fresh news developments and interesting stories to tell. At Talk of the Nation, we look for the stories that matter to you. From international news to the latest campaign politics to the issues that touch your family. Tune in for the next Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
Talk of the Nation this afternoon from 2 to 4 here on 89.7 NPR News. And stay right here in 20 minutes at 11 o'clock. Hour 2 of All Sides begins with a discussion of the latest in HIV and AIDS and women's health. Join us for that discussion from 11 till noon. 33 degrees in downtown Columbus, clouds and a high near 35 for today. A slight chance of some light snow tonight, cloudy skies, a low of 20 degrees. Sunshine for Friday with a high near 40, and looking ahead to the weekend, sunny skies with a high near 50 degrees. Support comes from the Columbus Metropolitan Club, presenting their weekly forum. Wednesday at noon, it's New at the Zoo, a discussion with Jack Hanna and others about the zoo's Safari Africa region, set to open next year. Tickets and more information at columbusmetroclub.org. All Sides continues. This is 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guest this hour, Michael Moss, author of the book Salt, Sugar, Fat, How the Food Giants Hooked Us. If you have a question or comment for him, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513. An email from Sarah getting back to the veggie issue. She says, I think the vegetable industry needs some better lobbyists or something. Veggies need commercials. Every time I buy eggs, I still sing that old egg jingle in my head, the incredible edible egg. And those pistachio commercials are great. I would have never thought of buying pistachios without seeing those commercials. I know this is outing myself as being very susceptible to advertising, but it's the truth. Yeah, we're all susceptible to advertising.
No, I think that's a really good point. And again, that's why I was so excited to hear about Jeffrey Dunn, the former Coca-Cola president, hitting on that very, very theme. It makes a lot of sense to me. I mean, the other thing that makes some sense, too, from a government intervention standpoint, is the huge amount of subsidies that go into highly processed foods. I happen to know that the White House is looking at ways to try to shift some of those subsidies to fresh fruits and vegetables, and some of that, well, could be marketing. I talk about in the book how the USDA has joined forces with the industry to promote the increased consumption of both cheese and beef at a time that people are trying to cut back on, or people are being urged to cut back on both by nutritionists because of their saturated fat and salt content.
There's a history behind why cheese started to get the promotion from the federal government. It was because of the skim milk.
Pretty amazing story. I mean, back in the 60s, we began drinking lots less whole milk because of concerns about saturated fat and calories. And we switched to either really low-fat milk or skim milk, and that left the dairy industry with a problem. It had a glut of whole milk that people didn't want to drink, and also milk fat, which it extracted from the whole milk to make the skim milk. They started making more butter and ice cream and increasingly more cheese. They made so much cheese that we couldn't eat all the cheese. The federal government, because it's been subsidizing the dairy industry for decades, started buying the surplus cheese. It accumulated, stored in, believe it or not, caverns in Missouri because the cooling costs were non-existent. And that went along happily until Ronald Reagan came into office. His Secretary of Agriculture discovered the cheese caves. They had grown to a collective pile of $4 billion, and they were starting to go moldy. And President Reagan said, this is the dumbest thing, and they put a stop to it. No more cheese buying from the federal government. But they didn't want to abandon the dairy industry, so Congress came up with this scheme. And it's basically, you know, it allowed the dairy industry to tax itself and raise tens of millions of dollars overseen by the Department of Agriculture that is devoted to increasing our consumption of milk and cheese. And this is in large part to explain why our cheese consumption has tripled since the 70s to as much as 33 pounds per person per year on average. Two things happened. One, cheese was turned into an ingredient, not just like an hors d'oeuvre you would have before a meal. So now when you go to the dairy aisle, you know, it's bulging with cheese, you know, not just sold in block and slices like it used to be, but it's bagged in diced, shredded, stringed, cubed tubs of cheese to make it easier to use cheese as an additive in home cooking. And then when you walk through the grocery store, you see cheese being added to products in ways that was there were never before. I mean, frozen pizza now comes with piles of cheese on the top and one or two cheeses stuffed into the crust. And the reason, of course, comes back to that great industry expression, which is mouthfeel. Cheese is a way of increasing the allure of foods. But the problem is when you use it as an additive in food, your brain is less apt to detect it. Cheese has, you know, being loaded in saturated fat, has twice the calories as sugar. And so it's a real issue in terms of obesity. A real problem, I should say.
Bob in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Bob.
Good morning, folks. Great conversation. My question is about what is all this processing do to the vitamins? Does the food become less and less nutritious? Are we getting – I heard what light destroys vitamin C. What does heat do to some of the other vitamins? Mm. Any word on that?
Yeah, I don't know the answer to that. I do know that the food industry historically used vitamins, starting with cereal, as a way of marketing their product. So they began adding vitamins, and there were some critics who started calling cereal, which used to have as much as 70%, used to be as much as 70% sugar, as sort of vitamin-coated sugar pills. So that's kind of the extent to my knowledge of that. I know there's a lot of discussion going on now whether we need to be taking a vitamin supplement or not, and nutritionists are on both sides of that debate. You know, I think ideally people would argue that if you have a balanced diet with all those fresh fruits and vegetables and whole grains and et cetera that you should be eating, that you shouldn't need to have a vitamin supplement unless you have sort of special health needs. But, you know, who among us eats such a perfectly balanced diet? I know that me and my family certainly don't day in and day out.
Thanks, Bob, for that call. We appreciate it. We have a tweet from Jason. He writes, this show reminds me of Michael Pollan in Defense of Food. If your great-grandmother wouldn't recognize it, don't eat it. Hmm. And that sort of goes to Chris in Mount Gilead. What you want to talk about?
Hi. I have a question. Like, there's a lot of people in my life that will, like, come to me and ask me, like, is this good or is this not?
Mm-hmm.
You know, should I eat this? Should I not? And I guess this goes into, like, how do we make positive impacts on the processed things in terms of, like, a grassroots movement? Like, how do we help change the way it is? Because we all obviously know that it's not, like, good to be eating some of these things, but I think it's sometimes inappropriate, you know, with, like, a mother and her child to say, like, well, maybe you shouldn't eat McDonald's every day, you know?
Yeah, no, I know it. So this, we're sort of dealing with that on two levels. In my family, we are, you know, trying to take a moderation approach. I might have mentioned my wife Eve, you know, works outside the home too, and we have two boys who are walking bliss points for sugar. And so she the other day sort of set a limit of 5 grams of sugar per serving of cereal as a way of getting them off the sweeter stuff. And what's really interesting when she did that is that they felt kind of engaged in the discussion. And kids are smart. I mean, they don't want to be overweight or ill in other ways. And so when we go shopping with them now in the store, it's kind of a bit of an Easter egg hunt for them. they will pick up the box and look at the fine print nutrition facts label on the package, and they'll hunt for those cereals that have 5 grams or less, and they're there. You know, they may have to reach way down low. In fact, they usually do, or I may have to reach way up high, because one of the things I mentioned is that the most highly processed foods and highly loaded foods are deliberately placed at eye level in the middle of the aisle, because their research shows they put devices on shoppers that measure their eye movements, and though that research shows that we gravitate toward the middle of the aisle at eye level. But they can find their cereals. You know, the basic Cheerios has 1 gram of sugar per cereal. Now, you know, you might not argue that, you know, even that's not as good as making your own oatmeal, which I try to do once a week. And actually, that's not all that, you know, inconvenient as one might think. But that's sort of our approach. And, you know, in terms of the grassroots moves, I'm hearing more and more from people that they're feeling this is a real tipping point, and that you need that kind of consumer pressure on these companies to get them to really make meaningful changes, because they're getting pressure from Wall Street on the other side. Look, these are companies, and they're in business to make money. Investors invest in them knowing that they'll make money. And sometimes when these companies have tried to do the right thing by nutrition in their products, they get pushback from investors on Wall Street.
Thank you, Chris, for that call. We appreciate it. Henry in Dublin, you're on the air, Henry.
Yes, Ann, Michael, thanks for taking my call. Mm-hmm. The other day someone pointed out an ingredient that I thought was unusual in yogurt. It was tilapia. I think it was tilapia protein.
Like fish.
Oh. Yeah, and I just wondered if you had any other examples of other foods that had an ingredient that was kind of unusual.
Well, you know what you find increasingly throughout the grocery store now is soy, used as an inexpensive, high-protein filler, and that's something else I'd like to look at. I know that there's been some concern about hormonal issues in soy consumption. I'm not sure how strong the science is on that. But yes, I mean, one of the things I learned in looking at, say, the meat industry, for example, what really drives the processed food industry is, you know, a term called the least cost formulation. They're always looking to find the least expensive ways to create their products. And the food chain, the food ingredient chain, has gone global. And so, you know, so cheese, for example, there's something called milk. Oh, I'm going to get this wrong, but it's like a milk protein concentrate, which is often imported as an alternative to using whole milk in making cheese. You can use whey, milk fat, and milk protein. And so, you know, they're very adept at looking and re-examining their formulations for components that are less expensive. And I suspect that, you know, tilapia, unless they're billing that, if you see it on the front of the label, then they're touting it as something that's going to be better for you. But in this case, they're probably seeing it as a lower cost way to increase the protein ratio of the yogurt. That's my guess anyway.
Henry, thanks a lot for that call. You said that the harder food companies try to please health conscious consumers, the harder they bump into the two realities. And one was their own addiction to salt. And you described how they want to try to cut it down, but they've backed themselves into a corner now.
Mm-hmm.
And then the relentless competition that one company might really be working hard to address these issues, but there's always going to be another one that doesn't care.
Yeah, there's a couple of cases I go through in the book. You know, briefly, Campbell's Soup, which is a fabulous company in so many ways, has been trying to reduce salt for years and years and years. They recently reduced the level of the salt in a smaller, healthy line of soups, and Wall Street almost immediately jumped down on their backs, and they reversed course. And Campbell added back in the salt they had taken out, just sort of on this threat of ill will from Wall Street. And the reason is that every time one of these companies does something unilaterally on their own, And that was the point of the 99 meeting, was try to get them to do it collectively. Their competitors, you know, Campbell's competitors in the soup aisle aren't lowering the salt in their food. And so the worry is, and the reality is, that those competitors will draw their customers by maintaining the higher salt and draw people who aren't paying attention to the salt load. So it's really, really hard for these companies, even when they want to do the right thing and do the right thing, to maintain that commitment.
You know, there's a product out there that a lot of us know of, have heard of, at least some of us grew up with it, Kool-Aid.
Mm-hmm.
I thought it was just interesting how it started. It and the guy who came up with it, you know, but when he cut the price during the Depression and really got to that idea of making junk food and food that's not necessarily good for us cheap,
mm-hmm.
so we can buy it.
Again, that sort of drives, and it reminds me too of Coca-Cola and the genius move by the head of Coca-Cola to make Cokes available to all these soldiers overseas in World War II at no more than 5 cents, no matter what the shipping and marketing cost was to Coca-Cola. So you had huge numbers of people who came back hooked on Coke. That was an ingenious move. You know, pricing has been another tool that the industry has used over the years, either lowering or raising their prices to affect their profit margins. But that's certainly a consistent theme here, which is that in the foods we hate to love the most tend to be the least expensive. And so, you know, even when you're well-meaning going into the grocery store and you know you should be spending more time in the fruits and vegetable aisles, it's going to cost you more.
Mm-hmm.
And that's very painful for people.
Michael Moss, thanks so much for joining us this hour. We really appreciate it.
Glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
Michael Moss is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist. He works for the New York Times, and he's written a new book. It's called Salt, Sugar, Fat: How the Food Giants Hooked Us. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.